Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Write Club. The first rule of Write Club is you don't talk about Write Club, but we'll make an exception in your case.
Hello and welcome back to Write Club, the podcast for writers and readers everywhere. I'm Teresa and today I'm joined by Pat, Heather and Stephanie.
Hello.
Hello. Hi.
And I'd like to say hello to all our listeners in Aarhus, Denmark. Wherever you are in the world, it's a massive thrill to know you're listening. We'd love to know you better, so why not join our Facebook group and let us know what you're reading or writing. This week we're talking about historical crime fiction. We interview the author Angela King, whose novel The Blood of Kings is set in the early days of Queen Elizabeth I. Stephanie will be sharing her work in progress with us.
Stephanie and Xander Cancel will share what's on their bedside tables.
Heather will be exploring an idiom. But first, Pat will ask us to...
name the novel!
Okay, this week's. It's a shame Linda isn't here because this one's actually an American novel. That's not actually a clue, that's just thrown in for good luck. This is the first in a series of 9 novels. Or the stories originally appeared in 1976 in serial form in the author's local newspaper, which was the San Francisco Chronicle.
Mm.
That either means that Teresa's on the right road or she has absolutely no idea.
I've written something down.
Okay. Although the author's name might lead you to think he's European, he was actually born in Washington, D.C. and raised in North Carolina before moving out to San Francisco, where the novel and his stories are set and peopled with a sort of vast array of characters that he met in and around San Francisco.
Nope. More clues, please.
Okay, final clue. The first book was made into a 1993 television miniseries produced by Channel 4 in the UK and screened by PBS in the US the next year. And it featured Olympia Dukakis in a central role. And she is one of the characters who stayed central to the whole 9-book series, I believe.
Oh,
mm. It's been described as a gay classic and authentic to San Francisco in the 1970s.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear. Oh. Well, our listeners in San Francisco will be screaming at us, won't
probably.
They?
Yeah, they will.
When I don't know. I can't think. A TV series, a mini series. Mm,
that's like, how I first encountered
Sex
it.
Sex in the City.
Oh God, no.
That's not gay. That's not gay.
No, I don't know. I've never watched it.
Sex in the City was much
okay.
later than that.
I've floored everybody here.
You have,
about
yeah.
You out there. It's Tales of the City by Armistead Maupin, which if you haven't read,
no,
I don't know, because it was very much of its time, I suppose, but.
I've got to confess, I've never even heard of it.
Really?
I
have.
I encountered it in the 90s on through the television series, and then I was so sort of entranced by it that I read the first few of the novels. I can't remember where I gave up, possibly about number 5. But I am tempted, I think, quite recently. I think the 9th one was published, which is about Anna Madrigal, the character played by Olympia Dukakis. I can't remember the title of it now. And it's kind of her going back, doing a sort of final road trip, because she's pretty old by then. I was tempted to have a look at that.
I can't remember where I was in the 90s. I certainly wasn't watching telly. I don't remember it at all.
No, I don't at all.
Well,
no.
You got us, Pat.
That's like me in the 70s. I don't remember any television from the 70s.
Well done.
Okay.
So thanks very much. Now it's over to Stephanie for a work in progress.
This is a short piece from Lacking Grace, and one of Grace's friends, Eddie, has just left the hospital in an absence on trial, which was quite a usual thing pre-proper release. People would be sent on trial. And obviously when one of your friends leaves in that kind of environment, it brings it home to you that you're still there. So this is what happened just after Eddie left. Grace stared at the empty space where Eddie had stood. She would be heading for her parents' palatial country house, her childhood home. Grace wondered where she could call home now and longed for the days in the little terraced house in Conway Street, which they'd rented since before the war. Then people grew flowers rather than food. She could almost smell the stocks and the honeysuckle with the fragrance that surrounded them on warm summer evenings. She remembered the frosts and occasional snow, which painted the garden and the downs beyond 100 shades of white each winter morning. Daffodils forced their way along the back fence every spring, throwing aside cloying soil and parting mounds of moss to announce the end of winter. On the mothering Sunday just after George's third birthday, Albert had taken him into the garden to gather a few of the trumpet-headed flowers the colour of butter and bumblebees. George had clapped his hands when his mother put them in water in an old jam jar and ceremoniously stood it on the mantelpiece. He pointed to them frequently, puffing his chest out and saying, "Me pickled those for mummy." Thereafter, the carters would go blackberry pickling in the hedgerows, workmen carried pickle axes, and children would be told, "Stop pickling your nose." Later that day, when Grace had finished clearing the table after tea, Albert had lifted George to stand on a dining chair in front of the clock on the mantelpiece, as he did every Sunday. The clock case was polished wooden, a rounded arch over the clock face with two tiny shelves at 10 and 2, beneath which it sloped more gently on either side. Albert would open the small glass door on the front of the clock face, using the little finger of his other hand in his cheek to make a loud pop as he did so. Grace and George always laughed. And then he'd insert a tiny key into a hole just left of the number 4 and wind it with a soft clicking sound. The clock was the heartbeat of their little home, marking the rhythm of their lives, comforting them with its cadence, ticking off each passing hour with a simple chime, telling them it was time for tea, the table should be laid, that Daddy would soon be home from work, and when to go to bed. Grace remembered George had asked if he could perhaps wind the clock, and Albert had told him, solemnly, yes, when he was 14, old enough to go to work, and not before. Grace gasped in sudden grief at the memory. The air stung her lungs and something inside her came loose. George was already 13. If she didn't get out soon, he would never get to wind that clock. "Grace is running out of time," said Mabel.
Love the clock sequence.
Yes, beautiful, yes, isn't it? Yes, poignant, really like that. Moving, really, really lovely. And a brilliant turn of mood there when she suddenly realises, actually, yes. Grace, you've got to do something. You're losing your children's childhood. You're missing out on stuff and you've got to get out of this situation. And then the irony of Mabel saying Grace is running out of time because Mabel is part of the problem. Yes. So I just found it really effective. The flow seems really natural from Grace's meditation on Eddie's going home to her nostalgic longing for happier times to the realisation that she needs to act, and some wonderful descriptive writing, just excellent in my opinion.
I completely agree. Enjoyed it. It's good.
Thank you. Pat, have you got me some grammar correct?
Not quite grammar, but a couple of little niggles, that's all.
Mm-hmm.
And I was confused at the beginning because I didn't remember who Eddie was. And when it said about she'd be heading for her parents' palatial country house, I was thinking that was Grace's, but I thought, that's weird. Anyway, but that was me. It was she could almost smell the stocks and the honeysuckle with the fragrance that surrounded them on warm summer evening. And it just felt slightly awkward.
You don't need the with, do you? That's no. When you say it like that, I realise it works without the with.
Yeah. Or even she could almost smell the fragrance of the stocks and the honeysuckle that surrounded them on warm summer evenings. Yeah, yeah. You're absolutely right.
Just ever so slightly.
Yeah.
And then the only other one was, I wasn't sure that you needed the before Mothering Sunday. I know it's like saying on the Sunday, on that Sunday or on the Sunday
It's a particular
after.
Mothering Sunday.
Yeah. But I didn't think it was totally necessary. But it was then the next.
It's the one just after George's third birthday. It's not any mothering.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah. Anyway, it was into the garden to gather a few of the trumpet-headed flowers the colour of butter and bumblebees, and I just thought there was one too many descriptors.
Okay.
I just thought either recast it or get rid of either the butter or the bumblebees.
Mm. Oh, it would be a shame. Mm. It would be a shame to lose either. I thought it was rather lovely, but maybe yeah. I'm not picking up.
Well, that was just my...
Yeah.
I quite like...
I love, the whole thing of winding the clock and the way that they made the same joke every time, because children love those rituals so much, and they're waiting for the punchline or the word.
And the pickling, I like the pickling.
Yes. I thought I'd found one, but I've changed my mind now. But I'll tell you what it was anyway. So she remembered the frost and occasional snow which painted the garden and the downs beyond 100 shades of white each winter morning. And I thought, well, if it's occasional, it's not each. But in fact, it is the frosts are not occasional. It's only the snow. So probably I'm wrong. But I'm trying really hard to find something.
No, that's a good point.
I think
on winter mornings would work as well, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
It doesn't have to say each winter morning. Mm. On winter mornings. Yeah. I mean, the message is that she's remembering the flowers and the summer evenings and then the frosts and then the spring, and that reminds her of Mother's Day. So
it's very, very well constructed and as I say, quite, moving at moments, poignant, touching.
It's lovely.
Good. And she's remembering happier times with Albert, which is important.
Yeah. So let me give you my notes.
Thank you very much. Thank you, everybody.
Okay. Thank you. Enjoyed that. Hey, Heather, what have you got for us this morning?
Well, I actually overheard somebody talking about somebody else getting the wrong end of the stick.
Yeah.
And so I thought, I wonder whether that's the same as the saying of the shitty end of the stick. So I've decided to have a look. And quite a few people have put them together, meaning the same thing. But there is a distinction that the wrong end of the stick means that someone has misunderstood something. If they've got the shitty end of the stick, it means they've got a bad deal in some bargain or share out. It doesn't seem particularly close to the wrong end of the stick, but it reminded me of when we went to the Globe Theatre in London and we went on the guided tour, and we were told about over the Thames, they used to have a plaque. I'm waving my arms about so the listeners can't actually see it. There was a plank at the side of the river, and you used to walk along a gangway and sit on the plank to go to the toilet. And
there was a hole in the plank, presumably.
No, you put your bottom over the back of the plank.
Oh, right, okay.
Apparently. to wipe oneself afterwards, there was a stick. And if you got the shitty end of the stick, you can imagine what that is.
Yeah.
So it just reminded me of the Globe and the trip, which was very good. But apparently, yes, that happened a lot with, throughout history, before the invention of toilet paper, proper toilets.
I think I'd have taken my own stick.
But then you'd have had to carry it about with you for the rest of the day. This is the problem.
Or drop it in the Thames.
Yes.
A collection of sticks.
Disposable, yes. Single-use stick. Okay, so today we're exploring the genre of historical crime fiction. Personally, I really love history and I enjoy crime fiction. So when I find a good crime novel with a brilliant historical setting, it feels like a real indulgence to me. Some people think that Ellis Peters' Cadfael Chronicles were the first historical crime fiction. The first in that series was A Morbid Taste for Bones, which is an excellent book. But in fact, the history of crime fiction goes back a little bit further. The first modern work in English that can be classified thus was a mystery, historical fiction and a mystery, is the 1911 Melville Davison Post story, The Angel of the Lord. This features an amateur detective called Uncle Abner and is set in pre-American Civil War West Virginia. And there were others. Lillian de la Tour did something similar in the 1940s with The Great Seal of England, casting Samuel Johnson and James Boswell as sort of Holmes and Watson-like figures in what would become the first of her series of Dr. Sam Johnson Detector series of stories. But, surprisingly, the first full-length mystery novel in a historical setting appears to be Agatha Christie's Death Comes as the End, which was published in 1944 and is set in ancient Egypt. Whereas now, we have ancient Egypt, ancient Rome, medieval, Tudor England, 18th century, Victorian, all of these things exist. I mean, do you have any particular favourites in the genre? Any of you read this kind of thing?
I haven't actually read that many, but, when I heard we were doing historical crime fiction, I thought, the only person I thought of really was Ellis Peters and the Cavill, because I used to love those. I'm sure I must have read odd ones.
Yeah, just
randomly picked. And I thought I'd read most of Agatha Christie. I don't remember.
Yeah.
That one.
I wonder if my daughter's an avid Agatha Christie fan and collected all of them in a sort of serial part thing. So I wonder if she knows that
one. I'm wondering if that one has a modern setting and then explores the ancient crime within the modern setting.
I'll have a look when I go home, because I've got the complete works of Agatha
Christie. It says set in ancient Egypt.
Right.
I do like the genre, I have to say. Yeah. I was introduced to Edward Marston, the first in his series set in Tudor England, is The Queen's Head, and it's set in a troupe of travelling players. Mm. Alex Grecian, who is much beloved of Linda's grandchildren as a children's writer, he started a series set in Lake Victorian. The first is called The Yard, which I very much enjoyed, and I hope to get around to reading. He's written two more, at least, but they're set in the year after the Ripper murders. So Scotland Yard are at a low ebb, having failed and in The Yard, we have a serial killer who's targeting police officers, and it's very well done. Mm. Since 1999, the British Crime Writers Association has awarded the historical dagger to novels in this genre. Mm. It used to be the Ellis Peters Award. Now it's called the Endeavour Historical Dagger. Nothing to do with Morse or Colin Dexter, but it's sponsored by a company called Endeavour. Yeah. And I think it's grown massively in popularity in this century, actually. But looking at their winners, there are a couple that I've read. Fingersmith by Sarah Waters.
Oh, yeah. Yes, I've read that.
Yeah. So when you start to look at it, you realise, I have read some. And she's a brilliant writer. I love her work. And one that I very much enjoyed last year, I think, Mistress of the Art of Death by Arianna Franklin. Mm. And when I knew we were doing this topic, I went looking for Arianna Franklin and found out that it's a pen name of Diana Norman, whose novels I loved. Maybe 20 years ago I was reading The Visage Mask, which is not a crime novel as such, but it's about the first actresses in the Restoration period, the first English actress.
I don't tend to seek out historical crime fiction, but I do like historical fiction, and sometimes you find one. So one that's very well known is The Name of the Rose by Umberto Eco. But I didn't read that thinking I want crime fiction.
No.
I read that thinking I wanted historical fiction.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and all the books about the Borgias, the De Medicis, and so on. There's lots and lots of crime in those.
I wouldn't necessarily classify some of those as crime fiction, though. No, but somehow the crime is almost incidental to to the history, isn't it?
Well, I think with The Name of the Rose, it crosses a lot of boundaries.
Going back to the Alice Peters books, I read all of them, and I'm still guilty of it sometimes, reading too many of the same author. And I went all the way through and sort of sought out all of them to read. But I actually find reading about Ellis Peters or Edith Partridge fascinating.
Yeah.
A life story and the work that she did and all sorts of things. So I got quite sidetracked then, finding out more about her.
Mm. That's quite interesting, because one of the people I read about, Nicola Upson, some of her novels are now based on the life of Josephine Tay. So in the same way, she became quite fascinated by an author. Mm. And so there were so many interesting facts in that author's life.
Yes.
Then she's actually written a series of novels all based around the life.
So Ellis Peters was actually Edith.
She was, and I should have brought the list, and I haven't done. I was amazed at how many
output.
Yeah, was incredible. And the list of names that she wrote under are just amazing. And there will be names there that you think, oh,
Yes.
I didn't know that that was in the
Yeah. Well, the same with Arianna Franklin and Diana Norman. It's one of, oh, right, yeah.
Yes.
But, yeah. No, but she was absolutely prolific. Yes. Amazing.
I used to like, I don't know whether it would count as historical crime fiction. I had a phase in my youth reading Victoria Holt.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And they were all sort of...
Jean Plaidy was another one. Oh, Jean Plaidy, yes. Mm.
But Victoria Holt's were sort of like romance, mystery... Mm.
Right, right. Mm. So there was an element of mystery.
Element of mystery and crime in the in a historical
setting. I read
them
at the same time as, you know, sort of a lot of the kind of historical things.
Well, as I say, when I read those books, it wasn't to seek out historical crime.
No.
It was to seek out historical, the crime for me wasn't part of it, but I thoroughly enjoyed them.
Yeah. Well, I do enjoy the genre. As I say, it's quite escapist, but actually a lot of these are, you know, like Umberto Eco, Sarah Waters, they're actually quite literary. Well, they are literary and they're enjoyable on all kinds of levels. And, you know, when it's well done, it's absolutely brilliant sense of period, sense of place.
I read quite a bit about the art of writing historical crime. Mm. And basically, all the things that I read, it's just that It's like any other writing. You follow the same rules, the same structures. You just get your research right of the time.
Yeah.
And I think, for me, the Ellis Peters ones appeared to get it right.
Mm. Yes.
Whether they did or not, I don't actually know. But they appeared to.
But the herbalism and all of that, she knows that very, very well, doesn't she, in the history.
It was funny, when we spoke with Angela King, she commented on how sometimes people put fiction into historical fiction and it becomes fact. So, you know, people will make things up, like there were, I think we talked about, there was only one of the princes in the tower was killed and the other one survived, and suddenly that becomes fact in some people's minds. So
yes, so the author is creating a fiction in a historical setting, but the reader doesn't always know which is fact, what's factual and what's made up.
So the fictive dream is so strong that people go away with, you know, misapprehensions about historical facts, which is great if you can do that.
Although you're not an expert, you know, when you're reading sort of historical fiction, most of us aren't experts in the period. But at the same time, I think authors have to be careful that they don't, you know, it's not anachronistic or they don't sort of go too far away. It's actually really quite difficult. One writer who was talking about, was a crime committed? It says it's easy to assume that because something's illegal in one period, it must always have been a crime. But in fact, laws changed all the time.
Yeah.
Laws could be brought in for a very short period because of certain circumstances.
Yeah. So you need to be aware of all that as well. Yeah. And
your history needs to be quite.
Yeah, and as Angela King said, you know, most people would be surprised to discover that in 16th century England they had autopsies.
Yes, this did happen.
So, yeah, you need to know your stuff. But I think also the readers, many readers have a specific period that they go for that they like, and they become expert through their reading of fiction, and they will spot things that don't feel right, even if you can't, hand on heart, say, I know that's not right. It doesn't feel right.
I actually found in a book I read recently that something that really irritated me was they were talking about having a cup of coffee.
Yes.
And I've written the dates down. It was supposed to be set in the 14th century, where there wouldn't have been coffee. Coffee wasn't introduced anywhere until the 17th century, and it's things like that that you think, ooh, and that then distracts you completely.
I came across one in a 17th century setting where the family sat down for tea. Now, tea as a meal... you know, I think would have come in, you know, would be post-industrial revolution.
Absolutely.
I don't know. I think that would be, you know, a working class thing where you call your dinner tea, as we do, most of us, many of us. But, you know, it felt wrong.
Yeah, because we looked at that as a sort of regional thing as well about having tea. Is it a particular regional area or is it a class thing? And it seems to vary from place to place. But it was very definitely when people started to not go back home for their midday meal,
when
people started taking things, you know, sandwiches or whatever to work, and the meal structure changed.
That's interesting.
But,
you've got to get your facts right.
It just rankles the
meal. It's language as well, sometimes. Mm. I hated well, I'm saying hated, that's strong, but there's TV things like, there was Robin Hood was one, and there was another one where the language was pure 21st century.
Well, that's a tricky balance as well, because if it's authentic, well, then it's going to be incomprehensible. There's a balance, you know, and if there's too much of the ing and thouing, you know, it turns people off. So it's an interesting one.
Yeah.
Well, I found when I was, I mean, it's not, there's not crime in Lacking Grace, but I haven't used the word okay in most of the text, because I just had this feeling about okay, and I tried to find some research on it, and it seems to have erupted with the Second World War. So being inside a mental hospital, she wouldn't have heard a lot of okaying because it very much came after the Second World War, and it's things like that, isn't it?
Yeah.
And every time I've wanted to write, okay, then I've had to think, all right, then.
So never underestimate the reader. That's absolutely the thing. Always respect your reader and do your best.
This I found really interesting, about creating a credible sleuth of the past. You need to ask three questions. What kind of person would have the skills to enable them to solve crime better than most in their community at that particular time?
Because there were no policemen.
No. So who would have had the right sort of knowledge, maybe about plants and poisons, or expert knowledge of weapons or espionage, stuff like that? What kind of person would have access to people at all levels of society in your chosen period? Because, you know, it was very much class bound. You know, you didn't get to chat to the lord of the manor and the serf on the estate unless you were in a particular category yourself. And what kind of person would need to travel?
Yes.
Because quite often, you know, people stayed very, very local, and very few people travelled outside the confines.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? You know, in terms of the books that I know of. So the Arianna Franklin, Mistress of the Art of Death, if I remember correctly, she is a woman who has trained as a doctor in Naples where that was possible in the medieval period, and is travelling with a group of pilgrims. And again, you've got that social mixing. And in the Edward Maston, of course, the players travel from town to town, and the audience consists of people from every level of society, from the groundlings to the top, and they would often play in manor houses or stately homes and so on. So
that's a good tip for writers. Good tip for writers.
Yeah, very good.
It goes back, doesn't it, to right to the beginning of the podcast, I think, when one of our earliest themes, discussions, was around research.
I think
it's essential in something like this.
Yeah.
Well, I think one of the things, we'll listen to Angela King in just a moment, but one of the things that came to me from this interview was how she is totally imbued in that period. She may have needed to research particular things, but it's part of her reading, her background, her interest. You know, she's in that period. Mm. She knows it well. And I think that tells in the writing.
Definitely.
Over to Angela King. We're delighted to welcome Angela King, historical crime writer and author of The Blood of Kings. Welcome, Angela. Thanks for talking to us.
Thank you for having me.
So tell me, Angela, did you always want to be a writer?
I've always written. Even if I wasn't a writer, I've always written. I think everyone has a way of diffusing their anxieties. And for me, it's writing. I don't know a time I haven't written.
What appeals to you about historical crime? Do you have a background in history or indeed in crime?
Not so much crime. I love mysteries. And I when I left college, I worked for, first of all, a theatrical costumier and then a film company. And so I worked on location, mainly making documentary films for museums. And costume, obviously, was my first. But I think that was the stage when I realised that I could make my writing into something more than just my own measure of things. Watching a director put together a film, editing all the different parts and making a story out of it really appealed to me. And I've never really been interested in anything but history.
Right. So you're starting from with a good understanding of structuring a story. That's quite interesting from filmmaking. You've learnt that.
Yes. A film can fail if it's not properly edited. And it, in some respects, you have to go back and do some more work, because when the editor comes in, he's often only been involved with a film right at the last stage. And the editor will say, well, you need something here because that doesn't make sense otherwise. And it's the same with a book. You do your first draft and you come to the end and you think, well, where are the turning points? Have I given enough drama? And a film's exactly the same.
Interesting.
That is fascinating.
So in The Blood of Kings, you've got a very colourful cast of characters from all corners of the world, different parts of Europe and from India and so on. And the setting is very specific. It's a specific moment in Tudor London at the beginning of Elizabeth's reign, isn't it? So where do you get your inspiration from?
I read history books and I love primary sources, letters, anything I can get hold of that's from a period. And what sparked my interest particularly was a ditty that was going around London after Edward was born, saying Jane Seymour had twins. If you look at that from the point of view of it was true, what happened to the twin? I can't find any twins in our English monarchy, which I thought, well, that's interesting. Surely there must have been at least one pair of twins. And that set the ball rolling, really.
That's really, really interesting. So,
that's brilliant.
Yeah, and we were going to ask, is it complete fiction? Maybe you could expand on that.
Yes, I think when you're writing history, you're weaving your characters into a situation, into a scene. And so all your main characters have to be made up, because you want to give their points of view. And to me, it's walking into different territory if you're actually trying to give the mindset of somebody who existed. But saying that, the reason I chose that particular year was when Elizabeth came to the throne, nobody thought she'd last a year. All the European heads of state thought she would either be assassinated or removed because they couldn't see any legal reason why she should be queen. So I thought, well, that's fascinating too. So you bring these different events together and you have much more drama than if you went to a period that perhaps people know a lot about.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And it's interesting because now, from the perspective of several hundred years later, it all seems inevitable that Gloriana reigned for decades, and you know, but of course it wasn't at the time.
No, she was not the character we, as you say, Gloriana was almost created towards the end of her reign with Spenser's poetry and the court actually. She was like a flame to the moths. Everyone gathered around her because she was such a bright character. And I think it was very rare for us to have such an intelligent ruler. But at the same time, the beginning of her reign is interesting because she wasn't that person. She was only 25. I mean, goodness me. And she hadn't had an easy upbringing, but she was tough.
So you mentioned that you like primary research, so initial sources from history. Where do you go to get that?
I did a degree in European culture with the Open University back in the 90s, and that gave me a lot of information about primary sources, and I picked up a lot of books at the time because even then the Reformation and Renaissance have always been my favourite periods, which is a big period, but I enjoy it. And I travel a lot. I've always travelled a lot. So I pick up any reference books I can along the way, and I have hundreds of books, I mean, literally hundreds. Online, there's a website called British History Online, and they're mainly primary sources, and it's an absolutely brilliant resource. Before that existed, I probably would have had to go to the library and get hold of a lot more information, specifically in London in the archives. But the information's there, but you can't always trust it. Even primary sources obviously have their own point they're trying to bring across. I mean, I've got a wonderful biography of Mary, Queen of Scots, that was written by her secretary, Bay. And he published that just after her death. But there's a lot of things in there that's so totally biased, you would have to double check them with other people. Also, when I'm looking at history books that are supposed to be well researched, I find that they often fall down because they've just copied other people's mistakes. And the more that you research a period, the more you find that happening. My big difficulty is getting hold of European research. The book I'm currently writing, which follows on, it starts in Antwerp, which was fine because my father used to live in Holland, and so I know the area. But I wanted some specific research, and it was always in Dutch. And I struggled for ages. And then I found on YouTube a historian who lived in Antwerp had made a wonderful series, which he had put in English for some reason. And it included all the history I've been looking for. So that it's all there. You just have to dig a bit deeper sometimes. Mm.
Can we come to the crime angle of your writing now? Obviously, there was no such thing as DNA and fingerprinting and that sort of thing in those times. But how do you find out about the process of tracking down criminals from primary sources?
Well, I was quite surprised to discover they did autopsies. The interesting one is Amy Robsart, who obviously was thought to have been murdered after she fell down the stairs. And that's in the year after the year I'm writing about. And I was so surprised to find that there was an official debate into her death, and they looked at all the different... And so there's a lot more than you expect. They didn't understand medicine in the way that we understand it, but I think sometimes we don't give them credence for what they did know. And my main resource at this point is just eyewitness. You have very little to go on other than eyewitness accounts, and that's what I've based my points on anyway.
Yeah, I guess that if somebody's liver was black, for example, they may have been poisoned.
Yes, and the smell of their breath. It's poisoning is interesting. I think there's a lot more poisoning going on. the more I read, especially when a woman's had five husbands, and I start to think, yeah. Especially when they've all been rich.
Yeah. Well, Catherine de' Medici in the French court thought to have poisoned lots of people.
I think she did. And so have you heard about her flying squad? Yeah. I've been researching that. Nowadays, you'd think it was clever. She kept a group of well-born, very pretty women who would sleep with major politicians and get information from them. And this is how she found out, or she got word of quite a few plots to overthrow the throne. She needed to protect her son, obviously, because he was, well, all her children were weak. But I think you're absolutely on the ball there. I think she wasn't beyond doing anything to keep the crown.
Mm. Fascinating woman. So you take the facts. So anybody writing historical crime needs to be able to take the facts, cross-reference those facts with other sources, and then using the facts, then imagine a realistic scene. So you've tested the logic of the world that you're writing about.
Yeah, I would always write my first draft. I made the mistake with my first book of spending years doing research and finding a good percentage of it really wasn't necessary. I mean, I love doing it, so it wasn't a problem. But I would do your first draft writing around your characters, because then you can really go deep into which areas you do need to know, or take out sections that just don't work because you have either muddled the history or it doesn't represent what you're trying to say. But I think that's the trouble. If you love any subject, you get drawn to the research. Mm. And you do need to know it, but I would always start with your first draft.
I think what I'm taking from what you're saying, Angela, is you're very much steeped in the period before even becoming an author, and very enthusiastic about the period. And it wouldn't work if you just had an idea and you think, oh, I'll set that in, let's say, 14th century Turkey, I'll go and find out about it, because you're never going to have that depth that comes from an actual love of the period. Would you agree with that?
I would. I think it would work for some readers. I find that the people who read history books particularly I think in Britain, if you're going to write about the Tudors, people are going to know about it. So, you know, I think you've got to be wary. But I wouldn't put people off. I mean, if you've got that passion, I think it would come through.
Mm. And do you think there's anything about a novel that has crime in it that is needed to satisfy the reader over and above, you know, a novel that's about, you know, coming of age or a quest or a journey or something? I mean, what specifically about crime do we like to see as readers?
I think it's that mystery of wondering who and why, personally. And that's what drives me through the plot, and that's what I enjoy in other books. I like that mystery, and then I like to know how people unravel that mystery.
Mm.
So I think that's my driving point.
Mm, that's interesting.
Mm. Do you have any advice for writers in general?
Just write. You listen to all these different people giving you advice, which I have. I've gone to some fantastic writing groups and whatever. But in the end, the only way you learn is by writing and keep appraising. I spoke to a writer at the weekend who's written 15 books, and he's a crime writer, not a history crime writer. And he said it took him 3 books before he found his voice.
Mm.
And I think it is just that time spent writing, even if it's writing and erasing and writing and erasing, which we can do on a computer. It's not so easy if you're doing it longhand. But I think write.
Great. Oh, that's brilliant.
So you mentioned that you're working on the next novel that follows on from The Blood of Kings. Can you say a little bit more about that without giving too much away?
Yes. I wasn't sure whether to write a sequel, but I had a few fans got in touch and wanted to know what happened next. And I thought, well, it would be quite interesting. So I have my favourite characters in history. I mean, the reason I introduced Francis Drake, who was supposed to be a much bigger character in my first book, I grew up in Kent. And the village I grew up in, Francis Drake grew up in. But everyone always says he's from Devon.
Yes.
Really gets me angry. He was born in Devon, but when he was still a toddler, his father had to leave because he'd possibly murdered somebody. And they went to Kent, and his father was the priest in charge of the dockyard, which was then the Royal Dockyard. And so he grew up in Kent, but very few historians seem to notice that. So now in this new book, one of my heroes is Gresham. If you go around the streets of London, you'll see his grasshopper everywhere, the golden grasshopper. Now, he's another of my heroes. So that's why this book starts with Sir Thomas Gresham, because I just think he's an amazing man and really should be the feature of a film. I haven't written the whole book about him, but there is, again, that character from history that I sort of use as my root.
Mm.
Angela, just going back to something that we talked about at the beginning of the interview, your work in film and documentary, have you thought about turning your novel into a script for the screen?
No. Although I've always worked in film, and I think I do see pictures as much as anything else. I mean, I think most writers do think in scenes. I haven't, no. I love films like the old Three Musketeers, the original one.
Yes.
I think it's so clever. And every time I watch it, I see things that I haven't seen on the first watching. And there's very few films that do that. Nowadays, to me, they're a lot flatter. They I don't know what it is, but they don't seem to have that grasp. You know, when there's a fight scene and there's something going on in the background, and you think, that's just amazing. It's so well written. I would love to see a good film made about the Border Reavers. I think that's another area that just nobody's ever touched on. And I sometimes wonder if it's because there's still too many hostilities. And I was talking to an agent who came up to the writing group I was with at the weekend, and I said I came from Cumbria, and he said, "Have you ever been to Carlisle?" I said, "Yeah." She said, "I've never been to Carlisle without seeing a fight." She said, "It terrifies me." And I said, "It's been going on for 400 years. They don't find it unusual."
Maybe we should ask you where we can get your book.
The book's on Amazon. If you wanted to order it from Waterstones, they will order it. I mean, our Waterstones in Carlisle stock it, but it's available on Amazon. Yeah. So most people should go on Amazon. Obviously on Kindle, different formats.
Yeah.
The second book, hopefully, I've just sent it out to beta readers. So I've got 3 beta readers having a look at it. And it's amazing. My first book took 10 years to really get into a state that I felt was good enough. And this one I've done in 2 years. So it's gradually getting less and less.
Brilliant. Yeah. So when do you hope that one will be out?
I hope it'll be out by the end of the year, but you know, I'm not making any promises. I'll see what my beta readers come back with and take it from there, really.
Well, obviously, let us know when you've got a publication date, and we'll share that with our podcast listeners and on our Facebook group.
Yeah, definitely.
Oh, that's lovely. Well, thank you very much. It's been lovely talking to you.
Lovely talking to you.
Yes, thank you.
I found her fascinating. I thought she had some really interesting points to make, and her point about the reader becoming so engrossed that they start to believe the fiction.
Yes.
And quote it to people as fact was that amused me.
Yeah.
But that's good writing, isn't it?
Yeah. And I was interested that she avoids using real historical characters. Her main characters are all fictional, and that's interesting because in The Visage Mask, which I mentioned earlier, which is not a crime novel but a historical novel, Aphra Behn is one of the side characters, and when I read it I was like, oh, Aphra Behn's not like that, you know. You know, because you have a vested interest in some historical figures, or some readers do. So it's quite a good tip, if you like, not to make a real person your key character, because it can annoy or
upset. Well, that's it, because people. If people have read other things about them or know other things, then it can jar, can't it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But no, she was really interesting to talk to.
Certainly knows her period.
Absolutely. And yeah, the basis of her novel, that's quite such an interesting idea as well. So
I would love the ability to do such accurate research.
Yeah, Well, I guess it just takes, if you love it, you have to love research.
Yes.
That's the other thing. If you love history and you love reading nonfiction and exploring, as she obviously is very much looking at original texts, you know, from the period as well. But as she says, they're not always the truth. No. They're still written from a point of view.
They're somebody's version.
Yes.
Mm.
Yeah. Mm.
Very much so.
It's nearly time to wrap up for this week. But before we do, there's just time for Stephanie and
Xander Cancel
to tell us what's on their bedside tables. Stephanie?
I am currently reading The Tattooist of Auschwitz by Heather Morris, which is... it's quite a popular book. It's been out for a while now, but I noticed it's got something ridiculous like 4.3 rating on Goodreads, so it's obviously popular. It's set in the Second World War, and it's about a Slovakian Jew called Lael, who is in the Auschwitz concentration camp, and he speaks several languages, so he's put to work as a tattooist to mark his fellow prisoners. It's a love story. There's also lots of horrific things. I mean, we all know what happened in Auschwitz. We don't need to go on about that too much. But he's in July 1942, prisoner 32407, which is Lael, is comforting a trembling woman who's waiting in line to have 34902 tattooed on her arm. And that's the first encounter that Lael has with her. And he vows that he will somehow survive the camp and marry her. And that's as far as I've got. But it's certainly, as I say, it's very popular on Goodreads. And it seems like the kind of story that's going to leave you with some fairly vivid images. So maybe not a bedtime read, but I read it at bedtime. So
thanks, Stephanie.
Now over to Xander Cancel.
Xander Cancel, what's on your bedside table?
The book I've just started is a book that my mother-in-law gave me called Grayson by Lynn Cox, which I am enjoying immensely, although I'm only a few pages in. And it's a book about encountering a baby whale, is what it's really about. But it opens with this delightful, some might think horrific, description of swimming at 5 a.m. in the Pacific Ocean and discovering that a shoal of anchovy have overtaken her and entering her mouth, and then a shoal of grunion are hunting the anchovy, and one of those ends up in her mouth, and then she realizes there are albacore tuna that have started hunting the grunt, and I'm at that point, but I'm hoping the whales have turned up, because it's sound like a nursery rhyme at that point, but it's a brilliant description of the ocean and swimming out in the ocean in the Pacific, which I've been lucky enough to do a couple of times.
Sadly, that's the end of Write Club the podcast for this week. Thanks for listening. Next week, we'll be talking flash fiction with Gail Aldwin. Don't forget to subscribe on Radio Public, iTunes or Stitcher, so every new show is automatically delivered wherever you want it. And please take a few minutes to leave us a 5-star review, or drop by our Facebook group and introduce yourself. Keep sharing the love by introducing a friend to Write Club the podcast. Goodbye!
Bye! Bye.